The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Satellite images show Russia massing troops, tanks, fighter jets, bombers, heavy artillery, and missile systems.
We encourage all American citizens who remain in Ukraine to depart immediately.
Canadian officials are facing mounting pressure from the Biden administration to resolve the trucker protest against COVID mandates as the convoy blocks crucial trade routes between the two countries.
Monty, who did not want to share his last name, is one of hundreds of truckers blocking the roads around Parliament in Canada's capital city, demanding an end to vaccine mandates.
We're going to sit here as long as it takes. The problem is they don't want to talk to us.
This unlawful activity has to end. We are a long way from having to call in the military, although, of course, be ready for any eventuality.
This anti-vaccination mandate movement of truckers, it appears to be spreading in Australia and New Zealand, and similar convoys reportedly being planned in the U.S. and right here in Germany.
The consumer price index climbed 7.5% from the same time last year. It's the highest level of inflation the U.S. has experienced in 40 years.
They are so far behind. I don't remember a central bank being so far behind. I warned that this was going to be one of the biggest policy errors. It certainly was one of the biggest inflation miscalls in the history of the Fed. And unfortunately, my nightmare is playing out.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Inflation rises to 7.5%, the highest we've seen in nearly half a century. The 10-year Treasury note climbs above 2% as mortgage rates rise around the country and signs of economic weakness are emerging as the Fed considers raising interest rates aggressively to combat rising inflation. That inflation, along with interest rates, are impacting the financial markets with greater volatility. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. John Roque is my technician this week. John is concerned over the breakdown that he's seeing in big cap technology stocks. As we discuss problems ahead for the technology sector and the NASDAQ, on the positive side is the breakout in base metals, which is inflationary. Later on in the program, author and energy expert Robert Bryce joins me as we discuss the energy crisis that is emerging as a result of poor government policies to shut down fossil fuels without a ready, viable replacement. What is now happening in Europe is coming here to the U.S. So be prepared for skyrocketing energy costs, whether it's reflected in higher utility rates or gasoline at the pump. Before we do that, let's find out the stories moving the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Well, this week was another Federal Reserve interest rate and inflation conversation between the consumer price report Thursday at 7.5% year-over-year and opinions from the St. Louis Fed President Bullard and the rest of investors through the Fed futures contracts about where interest rates will be later this year. And both are on the same page. Additionally, we got some positive comments from Dr. Fauci midweek that the full-blown pandemic from COVID may be behind us, which prompted a nice lift to airline and consumer discretionary stocks. Finally, Friday came louder warnings from the government that war is imminent between Russia and the Ukraine. So let's jump into the weeds on these issues. The CPI print on Thursday for January's inflation was hot, up 7.5% year-over-year, causing stocks to drop at the opening bell and bonds to fall, driving up yields. Stocks began to rally from the initial sell-off until a couple of hours later when St. Louis Fed President Bullard, a voter this year, stated he's open to see a full one-point increase by July 1st, with one being possibly a 50-basis-point hike and another being an emergency meeting reaction. Interestingly, the CME FedWatch tool showing the Fed Funds futures market was already pricing in this probability of around a 50-basis-point hike in March, but after Bullard spoke, the probability shot up to 98% versus 24% the previous day. The biggest fear on investors' minds right now is whether the Fed will be more aggressive than anticipated. By the end of the day on Thursday, the Fed-sensitive 2-year Treasury bond yield was near 1.56%, up 22 basis points, while the 10-year yield only rose 10 basis points to 2.04, cracking that 2% mark. Following Friday's volatile markets, Bloomberg ran an article on Friday that suggests there will not be a 50 basis point hike, and there will be no emergency meeting other than what's already planned on the Fed's calendar. Comments from two other non-voters seemed to soothe concerns Friday, with San Francisco Fed President Daley saying a half point hike is not in her preference. And Richmond Fed President Barkin said he's open to it, but not convinced. Because of these comments and the Bloomberg article, the probabilities dropped considerably towards a 62% mark from the high 90s on Thursday. Moving on, Dr. Fauci comments about the full-blown pandemic phase of COVID could be behind us. On top of airline Spirit and Frontier's merger news this week helped COVID-sensitive areas like transports and consumer discretionary stocks at the beginning of the week do well. The best performing S&P 500 stock sectors this week were energy, up 2.2%, materials up 1%, and financials flat, while the S&P 500 lost 1.8% as it struggled to get back above its 50-day moving average and closed back below its 200-day moving average on Friday. The worst performing sector was technology, down 3%, and following that was real estate, down 2.7%. Finally, on Friday, Bloomberg noted that the National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the U.S. believes Russia could take offensive action or spark a conflict inside Ukraine as early as next week before the Olympic Games wrap up, and not waiting until after they're done. As such, the State Department is advising all Americans in Ukraine to evacuate. The U.S. believes there are 130,000 troops now staged, and it's unclear on the scope of action Russia plans, if any. But highlighting the risks and the call for imminent action led to a strong rally in both treasuries and gold on Friday, with ETFs TLT, that's the treasury ETF, has a lot of 20 and 30-year bonds, was up 1.34%. Gold was up to $18.64. That was up $26 for the April contract. And West Texas oil was up $3.81 to $93.69. Commodities have been strong as money shifts out of stocks and bonds due to their weakness this year and into commodities. We often see these defensive areas do well when conflict is feared. The earnings season continues, with 72% of the companies within the S&P 500 having reported to date, and the blended earnings growth rate is about 30% by now and is the fourth consecutive quarter of growth above 30%, according to FactSet. Earnings comparisons for this year will be a lot harder than last year, with growth forecasts of only 5.5% for the first quarter and 4.8% for the second quarter, according to FactSet. None of the earnings announcements really affected the trajectory of market prices overall like they did in the past, with some of the big tech names in the past 2 weeks. Finally, looking at the economic numbers, besides the CPI print, which was very important on Thursday, the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index for February dropped to 61.7 from 67.5, where consumers see weakening personal finance prospects due to inflation, which is concerning. That's it for this week's wrap-up report. Up next, our guest technician this week is John Roque.
This week, we spoke with the well-known controversial forecaster Martin Armstrong to get an update on his macro outlook. We discussed his prediction from last year of seeing a 2022 panic cycle, which seems to be unfolding as we speak, as well as to get his thoughts on the Russia-Ukraine situation, what he expects for the U.S. stock market, and much, much more. Here's a clip of what he told listeners this week.
The shortages are going to continue. They're not being simply eradicated overnight. We're seeing the shortages in commodities getting worse even, and probably not reverse until about 2024.
To listen to this full interview and to gain access to all of our premium content airing 3 days during the week, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times.
Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us on the program is John Rogue from 22V Research. John, one of your latest pieces talks about canaries. We've seen some breakdown of some of these mega stocks, whether it's Meta, PayPal, and some of the others. Let's begin with that. What are the canaries singing?
Well, Jim, thanks a lot for having me back with you. Pleasure to be here. And I think the canaries, they'd be stocks like Facebook, Meta, Netflix, PayPal. If you take a look at 2U, T-W-O-U today, I think that these canaries are, for the most part, telling us to be careful with big cap tech broadly getting back to its post-COVID spring 2020 breakout. Now, of course, a lot of these stocks are already down a lot, but I don't think that most investors consider that there could be another leg down for these stocks. And I think that's what the canaries are trying to sing to us.
Well, you know, one of the things that these stocks are going to be running into trouble, let me just take you over to the interest rate side of the market. As rates head higher, whether it's, you know, on the short-term end where we're seeing that with the 2-year note or even the 10-year, doesn't that make it more difficult for these fast growth companies?
Jim, I think it makes it difficult for a lot of companies, but I don't know what the jumping off point is when the market will start to, again, you know, post this bounce, start to feel the effects of higher rates. I think the 2-year has been daring the Federal Reserve to raise rates for a long time, and the Fed is loath to raise rates. In fact, if you compare our 2-year Treasury yield to the comparable 2-year Bund yield in Germany, although I know it's negative, and the 2-year gilt yield in the UK, the Bund and the gilt are above their 2018 highs already. If the US Treasury yield 2-year was going to be above its 2018 high, it would be at 3%. So we're behind in terms of yield action and clearly behind in terms of Fed activity as well.
John, you just kind of wonder how much the economy can take with these rate hikes. The Fed had difficulty raising rates the last time. But you take a look at, let's take a look at the U.S. government debt. We were at $28 trillion in September. Now we're over $30 trillion. Consumers added another $1 trillion in debt last year. The corporate markets are over-leveraged. Doesn't this raise the possibility of maybe a financial crisis if you raise rates too high when there's this much debt?
I'm going to politely not answer your question, not because I'm being rude. I just think it's hard to answer. I mean, the Fed hasn't even raised rates once, never mind raised them too high. So I think it's hard to answer. I do believe, however, Jim, that the consumer might have, you know, a good amount of cash, and it would, you know, vis-a-vis what the government paid out during the last 2 years. And I think the consumers will, and please, I don't want any, you know, any nasty emails coming to me, but I think the consumer will generally be able to sustain the inflationary bite for a little while longer because they are flush with cash. It would not surprise me if they could, if the consumers contributed to further price moves higher because they will be chasing the prices so as to avoid paying higher ones going forward. I think they will contribute to it.
So if we take a look at within the S&P, you wrote an article about the base metals breaking out. I mean, if you look at copper, if you look at some of the base metal stocks, Glencore, Freeport, BHP, Rio, all the, you're talking about these big bases. Where do you see this heading?
Okay. I think this is one of the, sidelights to the market that most have not either A, paid attention to, or B, participated in. In fact, I feel very strongly about the second part of what I just said. But Jim, I think we're seeing the some of the effects of the unintended consequences of an ESG mandate. Investors via plan sponsors have been encouraged, if not demanded, to move away from what would be metals, mining, and energy stocks. And the commodity-related index, the Bloomberg Commodity Spot Index, off of the COVID low, has actually done as well or better than the S&P and NASDAQ. So I think there's a bull market for commodities. And if we're not buying commodity related stocks in a commodity bull market, well, then heck, we're never buying them. So I really like the iron ore stocks that you mentioned, Anglo American, BHP, Glencore, and Rio Tinto. And the copper, I really like Freeport McMoRan. Freeport McMoRan and copper, no, there should be no surprise, work together. And both are pretty darn close to breaking out. So I also like the ags. And of course, the energy part of the commodity complex has done very well. So I think this is a bull market. And when you have a commodity bull market, it tends to last for a little while. It just has not been particularly evident because it has not yet taken over on a relative basis versus the S&P or NASDAQ. But when you get commodity bull markets, they tend to outperform those big equity indexes, but it hasn't yet happened. It is in its infancy with respect to a relative turn for commodities to the S&P and certainly commodities to the to NASDAQ.
Let's move on to another commodity, which is oil. On the day you and I are speaking, oil prices are close to $90 a barrel. Some think they could be heading to 100. And a comment that you made earlier, John, about ESG, we're seeing not only Wall Street shed or get out of resource stocks, not wanting to fund them. It's very difficult in the oil patch right now to get funding. You take a look at that, and then you take a look at some of these activist investors that are getting on the boards like Exxon or even Chevron and basically saying stop investing in exploring for oil or either actually divest some of your assets. Isn't that raising a problem for the price of oil?
Well, to me it is. And not only is it raising a problem for the price of oil, which and I use Brent, Jim, not West Texas, because West Texas got to negative numbers in the spring of 2020. So it kind of screws up the price ranges. But so Brent has broken out what was above $80. And as you mentioned, there's kind of a consensus target of 100. I actually think 120 is something to look for. That's number one. And number two is further to your point, which is, I think, on you know spot on, the energy market cap as a percent of the S&P is still only in the 3% range. It broke down in 2019 from the 5% level. And so we've been saying for a long time, how many people have it, you know, in their kind of office pool that this number can get back to a 5% weighting in the S&P 500? And we think it can. It bottomed at 2% in October of 2020. At last count, it was about 3.5%. But I think it's going to work higher in the S&P and getting to 5%. So another unintended consequence of the ESG mandate to go along with your statement about the price for oil and all energy, all oil related commodities. So, of course, gasoline, low sulfur, jet fuel, heating oil, et cetera, they're all participating.
So where do you see some of these energy stocks? I mean, for almost close to a decade, the energy stocks have just been dead money. I don't care if you look at Exxon, Chevron, any of the majors. Now you look at some of the charts of the majors, whether it's Exxon, whether it's Chevron, ConocoPhillips. I mean, I've never seen such good-looking charts.
I think that they have further to go, and I think they will be beneficiaries of this commodity advance and commodity equity advance. So if you look at the S&P Energy Sector Index, and you could do the XLE if you'd like using the ETF, and you go back to the 2005 period, it's been a very wide swinging range. It's caused a lot of agita. The top of the range has been between, let's call it 650 and 710 or 720. And the bottom of the range, forgetting the COVID low because it really broke it, was 300. So here it is at 528, 530. So I would say you could probably get this back into the mid 600s area, which would be consistent with its historical range over the last 20 years or so.
So as we look at the commodity space and just thinking beyond, let's say, the next month or two, you take a look at some of the fundamentals that have caused us to get here. You know, we're looking at $90 oil. We're not funding oil companies. So instead of spending money on exploration, they're buying back stock. They're increasing their dividends. And on the other hand, some of these mining companies, which are very critical to moving to a green economy. I don't care if it's EVs or what they're going after. You still need copper. You still need silver. You need lithium. You need nickel. And yet we're not permitting mines here. We just stopped a copper mine in Minnesota. And so, you know, what about the base metals?
Well, I will tell you, I'm a big fan of the industrial metals complex within the commodity group, and have luckily been on top of this for some time. And I'll just kind of, you know, try to paint the picture, no pun intended, from a technical guy, as to what's gone on here for the industrial metals grouping. Please consider that the industrial metals grouping made a high in 1980, and it did not make a new high above that 1980 high until the autumn of 2004. So it completed what was a 24-year, and I refer to them as Brobdingnagian bases. So it's just a giant base. It then went up 127% over the next, let's call it 31 months. Now the same industrial metals index is finally getting above what was its May 2007 high. So now this is kind of a 14 to 15 year base, and we're seeing another breakout. Now, of course, there is no way I'm going to extrapolate the prior 126% gain after the breakout onto this time. But I will say you've built a big base and you've broken out of a big base. And when you do that, you know, you tend to go for a little while. So I don't know what the number is on the upside or what percentage we should be looking for, but if we had the Jim and John fund, I would be suggesting that we need to have exposure here.
And I want to come back to interest rates here because, you know, we're almost heading towards 2% on the 10-year. At what point do interest rates get high enough? It creates trouble across all markets. And even if the Fed raises a couple times, John, you know, they're so far behind the curve, number one, and number two, how far can they raise when the economy is this leveraged?
Okay, I actually took a look at this. I took a look at this with respect to the Fed funds and the 2 year. And I'll tell you what I found. So if you go all the way, and this is not fancy, so anybody can do this, and if it's laughable, what can you do? Here it goes. I went back to the early 80s, and all I did was count how many months it took for the Fed to start to raise the Fed funds rate after the 2 year yield started to move. So in the early 80s, it was 2 months, mid 80s, 3 months, early 90s, 5 months, late 90s, 8 months. And then 02, 03, 04, it was 1 year. And so I'm going to leave out the aftermath of the GFC because that's extraordinary. And again, we are at 1 year. So if this little exercise is helpful at all, it suggests that the Fed is as late as they've ever been based on this little remedial count. And it would seem to me, given where the 2 year yield is now, the Fed funds rate would have to catch up to it right now. It would have to be at 1.5% already if history is any guide. That's where it would have to be already. So I don't know how many hikes that will take them to get there, but it should already be at 1.5% because that's where the 2 year is. And if you go back in time, nearly always, in the very early 80s, in the mid 80s, it was close. Again, in the late 80s, it was right there. Mid 90s, close. Late 90s, right there. 05, 06, 07, right there. And again, in 18, you've got just about got there. The Fed funds rate gets to the 2 year. So 1.5, it should be at 1.5% already.
You know, the other thing, you and going back to oil, where you think it might head beyond $100 a barrel, this is another problem for the Fed with inflation because oil impacts everything. Everything we buy in the stores got there by a truck, a train, or a plane. And as that goes higher, there's nothing the Fed can do about oil. They can't create barrels of oil. The only thing they can do is kill demand by killing the economy.
I think you said that so well. I mean, the Fed can be active. The Fed can be active in the Treasury market, and you know, in many respects, push it around. They can certainly jawbone what goes on in the equity market, and they do this, I think, intentionally all the time. But as you said, they really can't affect the commodity markets. That's supply and demand, And they will have to kill the demand if they want to stop this. And I don't know that they have the chutzpah, I'll be polite, to do that here. I think they're loath to raise rates. I think the Fed has some other issues that they've been working through with respect to the news, with respect to their trading accounts and how that's come public over the last several months. So I think there's probably, you know, more on the Fed's plate than they normally have in instances like this.
And John, have you done any look at years of political elections? This is a midterm election. I can't imagine, John, the party in power is going to want the Fed to be aggressive raising interest rates, the market's faltering, the economy slowing down right before an election.
I don't have a historical answer for you, but I think that's going to come into play. But we have a policy analyst here at 22V Research, and, you know, he and I talk about this sort of stuff all the time. And, you know, he suggested to me that there's pressure on the White House and then, of course, pressure on the Fed to kind of do their best to ameliorate the inflationary situation that we're working through here. But can I just go over some numbers here just to give you an idea what inflation looked like? If you go back to the early 1950s, we've had, you know, prior cycles of big inflationary periods, just to give you an idea. So this, the PPI has not been released yet, but before the PPI is released for January, we have had 10 months in a row of at least 6% year-on-year results, which would be the fifth longest streak going back to 1950. There was an 11-month streak. Then, Jim, there was almost 3 years in the early 70s. And then, Jim, there was almost 5 years in a row in the late 70s to the early 80s, where you had consistent inflation of at least 6% every month for nearly 5 years. And then there was a 12-month period in the 07-08 timeframe. But in three of the four prior periods, the S&P has had some difficulty. And we can say that they've gone through bear markets in three of those four prior instances. And then today we saw that the CPI was released, and you've had 10 months in a row of greater than 4% figures. And there have been five prior cycles where you've had at least the same kind of results or worse. The worst cycle saw 117 straight months from the mid 70s through the early 80s, where you had at least 4% year over year figures for 117 straight months. And of course, today's figure of 7.5% is the highest in February of 1982. It's remarkable to me that we collectively as an industry continue to give so much weight or credence to Federal Reserve or Treasury Secretary commentary about inflation. There is no way that their indicators are any better than the indicators being used by people in our business to kind of try to determine or forecast inflation. And they're certainly no better than our own pocketbooks to tell us how much inflation is biting.
So, John, given where we are right now, you've got some canaries singing in the large cap tech stocks. You got breakout of base metals and oil. What would you be doing personally as an investor here from your perch as you look at the markets?
So I'll just make suggestions. This is certainly not advice. I think that it's probably right to have a low gross invested position. There's a lot of volatility here. The equity market trend has deteriorated. The internals have deteriorated a lot. So it would not be imprudent for people to keep their gross invested position lower than they normally would keep it. And I think that they would probably do a decent job trying to do their homework with respect to commodity-related stocks and or ETFs.
All right. Well, listen, John, it's good to have you back on the air. And if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so at 22V Research.
They can check our website and you could see the reports or notes that we send to our clients. And, you know, certainly somebody wanted to connect with me directly and chat that way.
All right. Well, listen, John, welcome back. Good to have you here. And you have a great rest of the year. I hope to talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jim. It would be my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So Prue, when we spoke to you early last year, you had believed that we were in the early to mid phase of this bull market. Given that we have now seen we're in the midst of a correction since late last year, give us an update on your outlook in terms of where the market stands today.
Well, Chris, we've had big decline under the surface, under the hood, although the indices have only dropped 10 to 20% over the last few weeks at the index level. The flow of liquidity is likely to get impaired over the next few weeks.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, there are a lot of investors that are worried about the economy and the market with the Fed raising interest rates. But there's another element that could impact the economy as well, and that's the price of energy. Why is it close to $90 a barrel? Some say it could be going to 100 or even higher. Let's find out. Joining me on the program is Robert Bryce. He's author of a book called Power Hungry, The Myths of Green Energy and the Real Fuels of the Future, and his latest book, A Question of Power, Electricity and the Wealth of Nations. Robert, I want to begin with Europe, because we've seen natural gas prices skyrocket there. You've got geopolitics going on with Ukraine, the Russians, and Russia supplies much of Europe's natural gas. Let's begin with that, because that crisis in Europe could be coming home to the U.S. if we don't change policy.
Well, Jim, thank you. I hope not. I really do hope not. Since you introduced me, I'm just going to do two more plugs. I also have a new film out, Juice, How Electricity Explains the World, is available on all the major streaming platforms, and my podcast, the Power Hungry Podcast. So I'll get the commercials out of the way at the beginning. But you're right. What we're seeing now globally in all hydrocarbons, whether it's propane, metallurgical coal, thermal coal, crude oil, gasoline, all of them are showing major price increases. And they're due to a number of factors, including, of course, the snapback from COVID. But also, I think it's critical to understand, Jim, how the Europeans and now the U.S. are abiding by these new ESG rules that are limiting new investment in hydrocarbons. And that is going to have a long-term limiting effect on hydrocarbon producers. So, I mean, in talking with people who are drilling for oil, they say, if you have the money and you could get into some of these drilling programs, the returns on investment are enormous. But the big banks, a lot of them are pulling back. And in fact, on the podcast, I had a guest, Joe Kraft from Alliance Resource Partners. He said they're the second largest coal producer in the eastern U.S. Half of the banks in his revolving credit facility have told him they're not going to lend him money anymore.
That's crazy. And I want to go off on a sideline, because you talk about, even our big, large oil companies, the Exxons, the Chevrons, Royal Dutch, British Petroleum. We've got Wall Street along with the government that are issuing mandates. You've got woke green fund managers that have gotten seats on the board of Exxon. They want them to divest themselves of oil projects at a time when the use of carbon fuels is increasing. This is absolute insanity.
Well, it is. And yet there seems to be this school of thought that only if we only choke the hydrocarbon sector, the world will automatically jump to wind and solar. It's just not true, Jim. And if you look at what's happened, we're talking about the prices of different commodities, the price of lithium, the price of neodymium, which, of course, is the key ingredient in high strength battery or high strength magnets used in electric vehicles. They're skyrocketing. And who controls those commodities? It's China. And this is something I wrote about in the Wall Street Journal on Christmas Eve. I published my piece on this very issue, that at the same time that China is consolidating its control over rare earth elements and critical minerals like copper and cobalt and lithium, the U.S. auto sector is going full bore onto EVs. I just don't understand it. From a whole bunch of different levels, it makes no sense.
Well, I mean, it's not just what we're doing here in the U.S. with our oil companies, but, you know, I'll take my own state of California. We had two nuclear power plants. We shut down one. We're going to shut down our remaining power plant by 2025, which means we'll lose another 10% electricity. The irony of this, Robert, is we're buying our power now from Arizona's two nuclear power plants. But what's worse is the governor has issued these mandates. After 2030, you're not going to be able to buy a gas-powered engine. In 2030, if you're a diesel truck, you're not going to be able to get in this state. We've already passed some mandates that if you don't have a rig that's newer than 2011 or updated, you can't come in this country or this state. And then we're going to start fining these truck drivers for pollution. So how's all this going to work? Because as you point out in many of your articles, a lot of communities are voting down solar projects and wind projects. Let's talk about that, because if we want to go green, well, then if you're going to put up solar panels or wind projects, you got to authorize them. If you don't build them, how are you going to replace it?
Well, thank you. Yes. I mean, and that is a key issue that I've been focused on now for 7 or 8 years. And on my website, robertbrice.com, your listeners can look at the renewable rejection database. Since 2015, and I have citations for each example, there have been over 320 communities from Maine to Hawaii have rejected or restricted wind projects. The number of rejections of wind energy alone last year was 31, and there were 13 rejections of big solar projects. So there are real physical limits, Jim, on how much the system can grow. And that's true of every system, right? But particularly when it comes to renewables, it's a land use issue, and the binding constraint on the growth of renewables are land use conflicts. And it's not just the projects themselves, it's the high voltage transmission lines as well, which is a whole other set of discussions that we can get into. But yeah, I mean, this myth, and California is leading the America off the cliff on these issues, it's going to have tremendously regressive effects on the poor and the middle class. And look at the rates there in California for for San Diego Gas and Electric. Some customers were reporting 50% increases on their bills in 1 year.
Oh, Robert, I had a house we built, and it was all powered by solar panels. Then the local utility changed the way they charge customers from prime hours, 9 in the morning to 9 at night. So I had to go out and buy another 12 panels to get rid of my energy bill. So even with solar, it could be expensive with the way they price it.
Sure. And you're lucky, you know, let's be clear. I mean, you make a pretty good living. And so you can afford to go out and buy that extra solar. What about people who are renting? What about people who, you know, don't own their home or, you know, can't afford that upfront cost? I mean, this, again, is another example of how class is playing into these climate politics, and how the people who are well-to-do, they don't face the same impact that the working class and people who have to commute. This is a big burden on them, and it's getting bigger.
Well, the thing that really strikes me about this is, what is it about dates? What is it about, Robert, the date 2030 or 2050? You got the catastrophist who will tell you, you know, the Earth is going to end. But what's so magical about those dates? I mean, our own governor said 2030 is a big date, 2035 is a big date. What is with that number or that year?
It's that the governor, the politicians who are making the deadlines won't be in office when it comes to when the deadline comes. That's the magic. Well, come on, Pupava, yeah. Clue in here, man.
Yeah, when the lights go off, they'll be out of the state.
Blame somebody else. They moved to Nevada.
Oh, my goodness. But, you know, the thing that really struck me about is the number of gas plants. You talk about natural gas and nuclear must be a big part of it. Some of that is starting to change in Europe. Let's talk about that.
Sure.
And is it too little too late?
They've committed energy suicide in Europe, and Germany in particular, Jim. I mean, what they've done, remember, just on December 31st, they shuttered three nuclear plants. I mean, this is insane, absolutely insane, but it's indicative of the power of the Green Party in Europe. And further, to do that, to make those plants close at a time when there's already, it was clear there was, you know, some looming conflict or friction anyway with Russia. So Germany has closed their nuclear plants and immediately made themselves more reliant on imported natural gas. I was fortunate. I was flattered. Testified before the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee in person in Washington on November 16th. And I'll tell you exactly what I told them. And Joe Manchin, of course, was the chairman. I said, the U.S. must not follow Europe's model. What has Europe done? They've overinvested in renewables and underinvested in hydrocarbons. And this is having major knock-on effects throughout their economy, including shutdowns of fertilizer plants, industrial plants, aluminum production. I mean, the potential of the ramifications for Europe and what will likely play out over the next few years, it's clear their effort was about around decarbonization. What they're going to get is deindustrialization and massive regressive taxation on the poor and the middle class.
Everybody wants to go green. We're talking about carbon issues and problems like that. One of the most efficient, reliable sources of power that's green is nuclear. What is it about the environmentalist? You know, they're shutting down the power plant here, our last one in California. They're shutting down the last one in New York. What are these states going to do?
Well, I mean, I thanks for asking, Jim. I hope that California can avoid this closure of Diablo Canyon in 2025. I mean, it begin, I guess, in 2024. And there were a number of, a letter was sent to Governor Newsom just a few days ago from a bunch of top scientists saying, don't do this. But, you know, this was the same effort that happened in New York with the closure of Indian Point, which I've been to. In fact, in my film, Juice, we went to Indian Point. It's a marvel, Jim. I'm lucky. I'm 61. I've seen a lot of the world. I went to, for the film, we went to India, Iceland, Puerto Rico, New York, Lebanon. You know, I've been to Beirut. I've seen people living in energy poverty in India. What they're doing with the closure of these nuclear plants is absolute, again, energy suicide. To close Indian Point at a time when New York is claiming they're going to cut emissions makes no sense whatsoever. And what's happened in the wake of the closure of Indian Point, of course, is that it's been replaced by gas-fired generation. So CO2 emissions have gone up. The cynicism of the whole thing, I mean, it just leaves me gobsmacked. And who's leading the charge? The Natural Resources Defense Council. Who was the former head of the Natural Resources Defense Council? Gina McCarthy. Where does she work now? In the White House as Biden's top climate advisor. I mean, it's like Lily Tomlin said, no matter how cynical I get, I can't keep up.
You can't keep making up this stuff. And of course, you know, it's kind of like with the pandemic. They always talk about the science, the climate science. It is so biased in terms of the thoughts that are being put out. I mean, there is less pollution and it's greener with nuclear power than anything else they're using. I mean, you know, you talk about, for example, land use. A lot of these communities are turning down solar projects and wind because they take up a lot of space compared to a nuclear power plant. And not to mention, Robert, you know, the environmental damage to birds, animals, things like that from these alternative energy sites that they're putting into use.
Well, I appreciate you bringing up the bird and bat issue. I'm a lifelong bird watcher. And the fact that they're putting up all these wind turbines and they're having clearly a population impact, particularly on eagles, and the environmental groups and the wind industry, oh, well, it's just not that many. Well, wait a minute. No, that's not right. You have a small population growth of golden eagles. You're in California at Altamont Pass. God bless the Audubon Society. A few weeks ago, they finally filed a lawsuit to stop one of those wind projects proposed for Altamont Pass there in the Bay Area. But I've done the calculations on Indian Point. Indian Point covered 1 square kilometer. To replace it with wind energy, you would need something like 1,500 square kilometers covered with wind turbines. It's about the simple metric in physics, power density. And it doesn't matter where you put your wind turbines, onshore, offshore, the power density is 1 watt per square meter. Power density at Indian Point before it was closed, 2,000 watts per square meter. I mean, you just can't, there's nothing else that comes close to that. I mean, some gas wells in the Marcellus, you're seeing similar power density numbers, but the math and the physics just don't lie, Jim. They are what they are.
The other thing too, and this goes, well, my own state is a great example. So they want us to go green. So they urged, things like hybrids, electric cars, But once you get them, I bought a hybrid. I got a hybrid tax because, you know, the politicians figure, well, if you're driving a hybrid or you're driving an electric car, you're not paying gasoline taxes.
Sure.
So we got to tax you for that. So they're talking about a mileage tax. They're talking about we already have special fees for hybrids and electric cars that you pay. There is one consolation. You can't go in the fast lane on the freeway, but that's about it.
Well, let me talk about, if I could jump back to the nuclear issue, Jim, because this is one that I've followed for a long time, and I'm adamantly pro-nuclear. In my view, if you're anti-carbon dioxide and anti-nuclear, you're pro-blackout. Well, I am absolutely anti-blackout because I got blacked out here in Austin a year ago in the Texas freeze, but I'm anti-blackout anyway before that. But what we are seeing now is this massive additions of new solar and wind in jurisdictions across the country with no understanding of the fragility of the electric grid and how we make sure it's affordable, resilient, and reliable. So you add in these other broad issues to the same set of issues that we're grappling with around import dependence on China for lithium, for neodymium, for rare earth elements. I mean, we're setting ourselves up for some massive dislocations, I think. And I don't take any joy in saying that, but the reality is very clear. And the Biden administration, I'm not a Democrat, I'm not a Republican, I'm just flat disgusted. But they seem to have no understanding of what is really happening when it comes to energy and power in the United States or around the world.
Well, the thing that really strikes me that the tech community hasn't said something about this, because you have big producers of the cloud. Number one, Amazon, Microsoft, followed by Google and IBM. Well, if everything's going to the cloud, that requires electricity. If we take a look at our modern devices today, we have iPads, we have laptops, we have iWatches, iPhones, all these gadgets that we have to charge at night, electric razors, I mean, you name it. And yet, as our demand for these kind of devices increase, they're cutting a reliable source. And I wonder if you'd address for a moment for my listeners. I mean, if you take a look at the grid right now, it needs a lot of work and investment. But the U.S. has coal. We have natural gas. We have nuclear. We have hydro. We have wind, solar, renewables. So we have five or six sources. Most of them outside of the renewables are predictable, unlike, let's say, wind and solar, which is, as you know, when the sun's not out or the wind doesn't blow, you don't have power. It's intermittent. Why would we trade five or six dependable sources of energy for one source that's unreliable?
You know, Jim, I think you've answered the question. I mean, it makes no sense. I mean, I'd call it insane, but it'd be an insult to crazy people. I mean, you know, we've got to wake up to what is really happening in the country. And it's dangerous where we're proceeding. And let me jump back. I lost my train of thought earlier, but let me jump back to the issue of nuclear, because this is key. China today, according to a recent article in Bloomberg, is building 46 nuclear reactors. In the U.S., we're building two. I wrote a piece in Forbes just a couple of days ago. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission in January rejected an application that was put forward by a company called Oklo. Well, Oklo is a nuclear startup. They had a new molten salt design for a 1.5 megawatt reactor, which is tiny. Anyway, they got rejected by the NRC. Well, wait a minute. We've never built a new design for a new reactor in the United States in the entire life of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Are we in favor of reducing CO2 emissions or not? It's clear that we're not, because the government will not move forward. The federal government will not move forward with new nuclear power. And further evidence that the Biden administration doesn't care. The Biden administration has been in power for more than a year. There are still two seats on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that they haven't filled. It's not a priority. They don't care. I say that with no relish, but it's just clear. The evidence is the evidence.
Can they not see what's going on in Europe with natural gas prices? Can they not see what goes on in California with power outs, or in your state of Texas when you have power outs with weather? Do they not see that in the consequences of that? It doesn't seem like they do. It's like, I've got an agenda. This is what I want to do. And we're pushing it forward. And I go right back Robert, to these artificial mandates? Well, by the year 2030, by the year 2035. So they issue these mandates without thinking it through. Well, wait a minute. If we're shutting down our nuclear plants, we're not building gas plants, we're shutting down coal-fired plants while everybody else is building them, and we're not getting our wind and solar up because a lot of communities are turning them down, as you mentioned, what the hell are we going to do for power?
Well, that's the critical question. And I wish I had an easy answer for you, but I think it's, you know, I do have an easy answer. What are people doing? They're buying Generacs. I do a fair amount of public speaking. I do 40 engagements a year or more. Lately, what I've been doing when I talk to an audience, I say, how many of you have backup generators at your home? And they're a sprinkling of hands. How many of you are planning to get one? And easily the number of hands goes up by a factor of two. Why? Because people are seeing more and more outages. And so what we're seeing, in fact, and what I had a piece in the Wall Street Journal last year, what's good for Generac is bad for America. I mean, we're seeing this company, nothing against the company. They're making a product that consumers want, but why are consumers buying it? Because they're looking at the grid and they're realizing, hey, this thing isn't as reliable as it should be. I don't want to be without power. And further, again, going back to the class issue, Jim, who can afford a Generac? Well, it's the same people who drive Teslas. The average Generac customer has a household income, median household income, twice the U.S. average.
You know, it's amazing because as I see what we're doing in this state, and like I mentioned, my house is solar powered. I've had to increase the number of panels, but I'm going to be buying batteries because, you know, my solar system is tied into the grid. So when we have a power out, in fact, half the homes in my neighborhood have solar. In the last power out, I was sitting out in the back porch and the guy across from me, his lights are on, but he has batteries.
Right.
So, you know, you're going to have to do that.
Right. Which is another major expense that you don't consider part of your power bill, but in fact it is. And so if you figure the number of watt hours or kilowatt hours that you use from your system and compare the total cost, well, I would assume that that's going to be far more expensive than what you would buy on the grid, but you want reliability. And so what we see is just this ongoing decline in the reliability of the U.S. grid. I've published data on this already. We've seen an increase in blackouts of about 13-fold between 2000 and 2020. I mean, these are massive increases. And we're just, you know, there doesn't seem to be any kind of understanding at the federal level or the state levels about the importance of maintaining this complex network and preventing it from being weakened and fragilized. But that's what we're seeing.
You know, the other issue that they're not thinking through, once again, they issue these mandates. They don't think through what the consequences are. And that's raw materials. You mentioned lithium, even things like copper and silver. The U.S. is not allowing new mines to go into production, one in Minnesota, one in Arizona, one in Alaska. So we need raw materials to make wind and solar panels, but we're not authorizing that or for, you know, making electric vehicles. So what does that do? It makes us dependent, like China, on key things from rare earth to lithium. They're becoming like the OPEC of the necessary minerals that to go green.
Well, it's absolutely right. And it goes back to the, you know, there is no such thing as a free lunch. This idea, oh, well, we'll replace hydrocarbons with renewables. Okay, well, then you're trading hydrocarbons for metals and minerals. Well, where are you going to get the metals and minerals? I mean, you know, where are the critical minerals? And I've written extensively about this. And last May, the International Energy Agency issued a report that underscored this problem. And they pointed out that to get a new mine up and running is on the order of 10 years. Well, that's if you can get the permits. But as you point out, the Biden administration just rejected a permit for a mine in Minnesota that could have produced different metals. I think it was copper and some rare earths, but there's just no getting around it. And the resource intensity, I've coined what I call the iron law of power density, which is the lower the power density, the higher the resource intensity. And that's clear from the IEA data and from other places. But when you start with something that has low power density, like corn ethanol, like wind, like solar, you have to put more resources in, more land, more copper, zinc, steel, you name it, rare earth elements, fertilizer, diesel fuel. All of those things have to be put into the mix in order to counter the low power density of the system you're trying to build from. So this could be another source of commodity inflation because of this craze and this huge demand for these materials.
If you take a look at a lot of these other countries, the Chinese and the Indians, which is roughly about half the world's population, they're building nuclear plants, they're building nat gas plants, they're building coal-fired plants. In other words, they're building different carbon fuels as well as nuclear to power the electricity grid because it takes this modern technological society that we live in, whether you're a manufacturing country like Germany, a high-tech country like the U.S., we requires electricity. And let's talk about what you discovered in your book, The Question of Power, Electricity and the Wealth of Nations.
Sure. Well, in A Question of Power, Electricity and the Wealth of Nations, as I did in the film Juice, I looked at the world through the lens of electricity. And when you look at the world, it's very interesting because when you look at it through the lens of electricity, it's very clear that the countries that have cheap, abundant, reliable electricity are the ones that are wealthy, and the ones that don't aren't. And this is just true all over the world. A couple of quick facts, Jim. So there are roughly 3.3 billion people today in the world who live in countries where per capita electricity consumption is less than what's used by an average kitchen refrigerator in the United States. So my old kitchen refrigerator used about 1,000 kilowatt hours per year. There are 3 billion people in the world who live in locations where, on average, per capita use is less than 1,000 kilowatt hours per capita per year. Those people are not content to sit in the dark. And that's what the other key issue that I learned, or fact that I learned in going around the world. I call it the iron law of electricity, which is people, businesses, and countries will do whatever they have to do to get the electricity they need. Full stop. I mean, you know, in India, they'll steal it. And that, you know, in some places in India, theft is half of the production. In Beirut, they'll pay the generator mafia. In Puerto Rico, they'll run small generators. I saw it in Louisiana after Hurricane Ida. I mean, this is just the reality of the world today, and it's not going to change.
We had this downturn in energy prices that began with the oil war in 2014, when basically Saudi Arabia tried to overproduce and drive out U.S. shale producers. That backfired. But what it did, it ushered in a long period of declining energy prices. The result, Wall Street got disenchanted with energy companies. They stopped funding, in some cases rightly so. The frackers weren't really making money. But now they're going after even the big companies that are making money and trying to get them to divest themselves of their assets at a time, Robert, we're seeing the IEA has come out and said that, you know, we could be at 100 million barrels a day of consumption. In other words, exceed what we were consuming pre-pandemic. So when we're consuming more, and for the life of me, you know, we may have electric cars, but I just don't see a 787 or, you know, one of these container ships with 20,000 containers running on batteries.
Well, you're right, Jim. And the battery issue is the other part of the question here about the supplies of lithium, supplies of cobalt, supplies of, you know, these other elements that are needed to make batteries at scale. And where do you get them? Well, this is the key challenge. Lithium production is a messy business. And the production of lithium is controlled by a very few countries. And the processing is dominated, again, by China. So again, there's no such thing as a free lunch. And Vaclav Smil, two of my favorite thinkers about energy are Jesse Ossebel from the Rockefeller University in New York and Vaclav Smil, emeritus professor at the University of Manitoba. Jesse Ossebel said, wind and solar may be renewable, but they are not green. And Vaclav Smil said, energy transitions happen over decades, not years. So this idea that we're going to force a quick transition away from hydrocarbons out of concern for climate change, I'm not doubting what the goal is. Climate change is a concern. It's not the only concern. And what we're seeing with this headlong rush toward trying to strangle hydrocarbons and force renewables into the system, it's simply not working. And we're seeing the global economy convulsing as they try and deal with this. And I'll mention one other thing. On my podcast, the Power Hungry podcast, it was, I think, a week before last, I had Joe Kraft on, the CEO of Alliance Resource Partners. They're the second largest coal producer in the eastern U.S. Half of the banks that are provide their revolving credit line have pulled out, and they won't be able to. They said after, I think it's next year, they're not going to lend Alliance any more money. Not because Alliance is doing anything illegal or immoral. It's just because of ESG.
Yeah, I've seen it with energy companies, the same thing. So, I mean, we've been telling people we were headed for $100 oil. We were telling people that last year, Robert. You know, we got invested in energy. But I see energy prices going higher, and we're all spending a lot of time talking about the Fed raising interest rates. I personally don't think they're going to be able to get all the rates that Wall Street thinks they are. But at the same token, people aren't paying attention what, you know, $100 oil can mean for the economy, or even worse, $150. We saw what happened in 2008 when it hit $150.
Right. And recessions are closely correlated with these high oil prices. And who's going to pay the biggest price? It's going to be the poor and the middle class. You know, I'm fortunate. I live in Austin, Texas. I have a nice house. But, you know, a lot of the people that, you know, contractors, people I know, they have to drive, and they drive long distances. Some of them can't afford to live in Austin, so they live outside of town. There's no benefit to them from high oil prices, none. It's all negative for them. And yet, you know, people I know and I said, oh, well, the energy prices are too low. They need to be higher. Well, it's easy to say that if you're comfortable and you make a lot of money or don't have, you know, you don't drive very much. But for the working class, this is just a tax on their income that they will never get back.
One of the things I see, Robert, we're not reversing policy. The mandates are getting more serious. The restrictions they're putting in on the energy sector, whether it's getting them to divest or shutting down plants, to me, I see an energy crisis coming. If our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them about, number one, your books, your podcast, but also the movie on Juice. Now, can you get Juice on Netflix?
Juice is not on Netflix. However, it's on virtually every other major streaming platform. You can even watch it for free on the Roku channel, which I'm not doing myself a service here, but it's available on Roku channel. It's called Juice, How Electricity Explains the World. You can find me. I'm on my website is robertbrice.com. So I post nearly all of my articles there. I'm on Twitter at Power Hungry, at PWR Hungry. And my podcast is available on all the major streaming podcast outlets and on YouTube. But the podcast is the Power Hungry Podcast.
And I want to put a plug in for your books. I've read both of them, Power Hungry, The Myths of Green Energy and the Real Fuels of the Future, and your latest book, A Question of Power, Electricity and the Wealth of Nations. And we've been speaking with its author, Robert Brice. Robert, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Hopefully, you know, some of these politicians are going to get a wake-up call. We can only hope.
We can pray, Jim.
Yep. Hey, it's going to take a lot of prayers, my friend. So take care, Robert.
All right. That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888, that's 888-486-3939, or go to financialsense.com and click where it says contact us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.